It's a privilege to give a talk like this, particularly with so many experts in the audience. And what I want to do today, I'm going to essentially, at Toronto, particularly with Yoji Ohashi, a collaborator in Japan, we've, over the last 3 or 4 years, in fact, have been working on this topic. I started on this topic a long time ago in connection with superconductors, but almost over 10 years ago. And I'll report basically a specific model that we've done calculations on and some of the results. And I'm going to try to give you a picture of within this model, which I'll describe, a specific model, which I think is rich enough to describe a lot of the physics, but maybe not might not have everything in it, to sketch a theory of the formation of diatomic molecules, bound states, and also the Bose condensation of such diatomic molecules, which are usually spin zero, in a two-component, i.e. spin-up, spin-down, degenerate atomic Fermi gas. And also within this simple microscopic model, I'll basically argue that from our calculations, one sees that there's no fundamental difference between a molecular Bose condensate of real molecules and what experimentalists often talk about real molecules. As a many body theorist, I think this word real should be put in quotes. Because molecule is molecule. and the superfluid phase of Cooper pairs, that is a BCS state. And I'll try to argue about this, convince you of this. As I say, all my work has been done in close collaboration with Yoji Ohashi, who was a sabbatical visitor at Toronto a couple of years ago, and is actually an expert in high TC and superconductivity, so this is a sort of perfect problem. He wanted to get involved in the cold gases, so it was an ideal problem. It's worked out very well. I might say the calculations that lie behind our work are mainly done by Ohashi, Yoji, and he tells me that they're very demanding calculations. Some of the results I'll report towards the end of the talk at one point involved 3 giant computers in Japan chugging away for several months. This is for a real trapped gas, not a uniform gas. Anyway, basically I'm going to cover 4 topics. Let me just give a quick little introduction. Some of this, these slides, as we all know, come from other talks, and this is sort of more introductory, but I'll very quickly just remind you what a Feshbach resonance is between 2 atoms in a vacuum, the two-body problem. And of course, it's this type of resonance which is the key in all the recent experiments involving all excitement in a Fermi gas, in particular the formation of diatomic molecules and the Bose condensation of these diatomic molecules and reaching the BCS state and what have you. And it's really a remarkable development, which I think will have revolutionary effects in this field in the next few years. In any event, now, very quickly, in a couple of minutes, review the BCS theory of superconductivity without a Feshbach resonance. And just to remind you that, of course, that's the BCS theory of superconductivity is a very simple theory, you know, in physics terms, namely, it's the formation of a bound state, Cooper pair, which I view as a molecule, in a Fermi gas, but due to many body effects, rather than due to a bound state and a two-body potential. Of course, the BCS quasiparticles which result are fermions, and these fermions now, of course, move in a sea of a Bose condensate of Cooper pairs, and of course, that gives rise to the famous energy gap. One of the themes of my talk is that one of the most interesting things about Fermi gases is that they still have a Fermi spectrum, which somehow experimentalists don't seem to be interested in. Then I'll discuss the transition from the usual BCS state of large overlapping Cooper pairs, which is standard BCS theory, to a BEC gas of small Cooper pairs, where the Cooper pairs can really be viewed in the extreme limit, the so-called BEC limit, as just a Bose gas. This famous BCS-BEC crossover, I noticed many people call it the BEC-BCS crossover, including Tony. But it's simply because originally it was started from BCS and superconductivity and you're working down to the BEC. Of course, our cold gas community starts with often a BEC and works up to BCS. Anyway, it's the same phenomenon. And of course, this crossover, as I'll review, simply results when you have an attractive interaction, a real attractive interaction, say, between the fermions, and you simply simply increase the strength of this, and you go from the so-called BCS region to the BEC region. And it's this crossover which is now, just in the last year, now accessible to experimental study for the first time. Then I'm going to introduce the model that we have actually worked with, the interacting fermion-boson model, which incorporates the creation of molecules by a two-body Feshbach resonance, and as well as the many-body BCS effects, let's say. And this is often now in the jargon of the trade called a two-channel model, because we actually have, in some sense, fermions coupling in with a bound state associated with the formation of the molecule. And of course, we're trying to do this whole problem for an interacting system with order parameters and what have you. But anyway, I'll try to, as I said, try to show there's no fundamental difference between these two phenomena. Well, in one slide, let me just remind you what the Feshbach resonance is. And here, I apologize, in a sense, throughout the rest of the talk, I'll have slides using different ways of plotting the x-axis here. This is just an example of lithium-6, for instance, from Randy Houlette's work. Here's a scattering length, you know, going up to 500 in terms of the Bohr radius. And essentially, this is just two-body physics. It's known that in this system, well, known in quotes, you know, molecules only form when A, the scattering, first of all, you're working at very low temperature, so the only channel we have to worry about is the S-wave scattering length between opposite spins, okay? When A is greater than zero, and experimentally, you usually plot this as a function of the magnetic field, and there's a certain value B0 where you have the resonance, and essentially here you can see A is negative in this region here. This is called the BCS region, and here A is A will be positive, and this is called BEC region in some sense. Of course, all the action is right around this so-called Feshbach resonance. Simple theories of this two-body physics find that the scattering length, S-wave scattering length, can be written in this schematic form here, where B0 is the magnetic field that appears here, and W gives you the width of the resonance. Now, the language I'm going to use shortly is that clearly the B minus B0, so this is magnetic field and this is B0, B minus B0 is also called a detuning, okay? So this would be positive detuning, delta, and negative detuning. And I'll often work with a function for very obscure reasons, which even I don't understand, it's called 2 mu, which is essentially, you can think of as the energy of a molecule in the system, okay? And essentially, when 2 nu goes to zero, that is, when B is equal to B0, it means the energy of the molecule is right at the vacuum level, and when 2 nu becomes negative, then you can actually form real bound state. If 2 nu is positive, coupled with a Fermi gas, of course, you're dealing with a resonant state. So 2 nu positive is in this region, 2 nu negative is in this region, but here A is positive, and here A is negative. In any event, just let me just quickly remark, for those who are maybe not familiar with it, that by slowly, often in experiments, you start in this region here, you slowly ramp from this region here from A less than zero to A greater than zero to below the resonance, and you find long-lived dimer molecules appear, which, because you've done the ramping slow enough, can thermalize with the rest of the atoms and the molecules, and actually form a molecular Bose condensate of these diatomic molecules. That's a so-called molecular Bose condensate.
Could you tell us which spin channel are these molecules in, and what roughly is their spectral structure?
No. Well, I mean, that would get me, maybe I can, I understand why you're asking that question, but I'd prefer not to go into it, in the sense it deals with a question which, as we've discussed, it is not directly applicable, I mean, relevant to the work I'm actually deal with here. But basically, when I'm dealing with, first of all, because I have to then introduce the spin of the electronic spin, which is obviously related to, in the Feshbach resonance, the closed channel, the molecular channel. Maybe, in fact, I might come back to that, if you don't mind, yes, in a couple of slides, because I do have pictures.
I mean, I just wonder if experimentalists could tell you this. Are there molecules of the order of a few angstroms, or are they of the order of thousands of angstroms?
Yes. This is a topic of great interest, which will only peek its head above the radar screen every so often in my talk, but it's a very crucial question.
Can I make one comment?
Yep.
It seems to me that the talking about these two channels as being distinct is confusing, because really the molecules have a large component in channel with the two atoms. And so they're not really orthogonal spin states.
Well, the combined spin state in the open atom, and if we go far from those things, then we have two atoms colliding in the open channel, let's say with spin whatever, minus one half. Sorry, minus one half, minus 7 half. And then we have a molecule, a very tight bound molecule, if you're a few angstrom size, sitting in a different channel, which has
It's sitting half in that channel.
The molecule exists.
The thing is, if you two and I get involved in this discussion, I'm not going to be able to give my seminar. but I might say that, in fact, I think it's useful to sort of do these problems at different levels. And here, in some sense, I'm going to introduce a molecule, and it's related, closed channel and all this sort of stuff. But in some sense, I'm not going to really discuss too much about the internal microscopic details of that molecule. Because that, in some sense, is another question that comes. The question is, you've got this molecule, what happens to it? How does it interact with the Fermi gas? But it's clear the next step, which I'm not going to be discussing in my seminar, is, in fact, the type of question that Tony is addressing, namely a more peeling apart what that molecule is, and, in fact, and how's it evolved. Yeah?
Is the point that the two eigenstates are linear combinations of these, and they're two orthogonal... presumably states that are different combinations of
them.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
It's a coupled.
What happens is that there are two electronic states, yes? In the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, what you do, you write that the wave function is a product, electronic wave function multiplied the wave function of relative motion, yes? There are two electronic states involved, yes, and there is a coupling equilibrium. So the total wave function is a linear superposition of the two, yes? Mm-hmm. But one of these electronic states, for example, for positive A, has a bound state, yes? And then you write down linear combination in such a way that you include this coupling, and then this coupling modifies the relative motion of particles in the incoming channel. It modifies it in such a way that the phase shift corresponding to behavior of the wave function at large distances becomes corresponding to this large positive.
But I think that this picture is confusing because it forgets about the nuclear spin.
Because the usual treatment, for those who don't know very much about molecules, usual treatment, of course, molecules, it's two different electronic states, and you're talking about electronic spin, not the total spin or the nuclear spin.
But maybe we should.
I think it's
very important.
Yeah. Okay. Let's actually discuss something that's not controversial, namely BCS theory of superinductors.
Well, we need to become
agents.
What?
Just a very simple question.
Yeah.
Since you have already understood what the molecule is.
Yeah.
I'm
thinking about it.
Yes. When people give talks in the audience of condensed matter people,
they
are very polite. They don't ask
the
question. But sometimes the question is asked.
Yeah.
Why? The bound state, weakly bound state, is formed for a positive scattering gas.
Yeah, yeah.
Why not negative?
Yeah.
Could you answer this question for
me? Like an oral exam.
No. All I can say is I go through the accounts and the well-known books by Feder and Velechka and what have you, and
yes.
That's what it comes out.
Is it possible to say in a couple of sentences?
Second order perturbation theory.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was a resonance. If you have a square well, and it make the square well more attractive, as you pass through, as a bound state just forms, the phase shift changes the pi over two resonance.
Yeah. But that's the math. That's the math.
Let me make a statement which I believe is uncontroversial, whatever it is. The fact that I have a bound state sitting just below the continuum implies that in the scattering state, AS must be positive. The converse is not true, necessarily. E.g., false this.
Just a very simple question. Imagine, please, that you are now in 1D, one-dimensional case. So your molecules are one-dimensional and so on. And there is, again, this coupling constant. The functional potential. Then this coupling constant, will it be positive or negative for the molecular state in 1D?
I definitely wouldn't answer that, refuse to answer that, although it's a very interesting topic, because as I'll mention later, a lot of very nice papers were written in the 80s by, in the early 90s, I guess, by Mohit Randeria, who actually, I guess, gave a talk at this symposium or workshop a few weeks ago. And he in particular studied the two-dimensional system. And I know there, and I've at least read those accounts, there the whole question of bound states and how they're related to scattering resonances and all that sort of stuff is quite different than 3D. So I imagine in 1D it's even worse, but it's a topic I'm sure Jora is going to clarify in the next year or two. BCS theory of superinductors.
Yeah.
So
if the only bound state side of the resonance approach the resonance value, does the size of the molecule diverge?
I'll address that if you let me get there. But it's this topic actually is I don't think there's definitive answers to that question, because it's related to what we mean by the molecule. And you'll see the molecules I'm dealing with, the molecules, well, you'll see my answer to that. In any event, let me just remind you, a two-component Fermi gas with an attractive S-wave interaction is unstable to the formation of a bound state, which is a boson of two fermions. And this Cooper pair, which all condensed matter people learned a long time ago.
S equals zero if
you're
talking about helium 3.
Agree. You're right. S equals 0, 1.
Or 1.
Yeah. I'll correct that. Anyway, this Cooper pair, though, is this molecule, okay? This molecule is, of course, a many-body effect. So really, I view now, which I didn't in the old days when I used to study books like Feder and Velechka and what have you, I used to view, as many of the condensed matter or the atomic and molecular people still view, that the Cooper pair was some exotic sort of thing. It was somehow something in momentum space. We heard a lot of that at the conference. And I think this is very, very misleading. The Cooper pair, what Cooper did in 1957 was gave the first theory of a molecule in a degenerate gas. That's what he did, okay? Anyway, it's a many-body effect. Only arises, of course, in degenerate Fermi gas. Or when I say only, I mean, we'll see it arises elsewhere. But it doesn't depend on the interatomic potential having a bound state. But let me just remark, which I'll do when I'm discussing the BCS-BEC crossover, is, of course, the fact that A goes from negative to above, from above the resonance to A being positive below the resonance, that is the scattering length between the opposite spins, where these spins now, of course, hyperfine states, can, of course, occur even if you're dealing with an attractive interaction. So the way you should think of it, because I know it's Vinay Amagokar, my advisor, seems to be still not clear about this, for a given attractive interaction, a real attractive interaction in space, by simply increasing the strength of this attractive well, as in some sense Sandy was mentioning, you can go from the region where A is negative to A is positive for just increasing the strength of the real attractive interaction. Not so the scattering lengths, even though one crudely speaks about A being negative or positive, repulsive and attractive, one has to keep that in mind. Okay, anyway, these Cooper pairs form at the BCS temperature, which is the temperature which they also Bose condense, which is a confusing thing about the original BCS theory, and produce a Cooper pair condensate. Yeah, the remaining.
They emphasize that two fermions are not a boson.
Hmm? Yeah, but that's understood now. That was just strictly for political reasons. I mean, because they wanted to distance themselves. They are bosons, completely bosons. Yeah.
So not everyone agrees.
Anyway, they produce a Cooper pair. they produce a Cooper pair condensate. The remaining Fermi atoms swim around in this condensate soup, and of course that's where you get a gap. But I make this point right now because later on I want to point out in these new systems that we're studying, one of the best ways of studying the nature of the condensate, the nature of the Bose condensate of bound states, is to study, somewhat surprisingly, the single particle excitation and study its gap, okay? Because that's a very direct probe of this many-body effect delta. Okay, well, let me just quickly remind you of BCS theory. Mathematically, H minus mu n, where this is a chemical potential, and we have the usual attractive interaction. So U being positive means attractive in my notation. And here I'm just using a uniform gas. And we all know that the BCS theory, worked out properly by Gorkov very quickly, is simply corresponds going from here to here, where you introduce this mean field delta here, which is this so-called off-diagonal mean field, which is defined by U and this broken symmetry value of the so-called Cooper pair amplitude.
Certainly not Bose field operators. Those pair operators certainly don't satisfy Bose commutation relations.
But Marvin, we're in 2004. We're not in 1967. the main thing is the essential physics is Bose condensation, which as far as I know was really first clearly pointed out by Gorkov in his famous 1957 paper. Already, okay? The essential physics. Now there's a few complications, and particularly in the extreme BCS limit, they're not, strictly speaking, bosons. But what's the first approximation? The way to think about it is bosons. And a huge number of condensed matter students and professional physicists all over the condensed matter community don't understand the BCS theory because they've never, for instance, understood these three lines. Okay. Anyway, so... I have a different opinion of Yang's contributions. Gorkov is the person who understood the BCS theory. And it's very nice they got the Feinberg Medal this year with Belyaev, in fact. In any event, this so basically, once you have this, you can see it's a sort of quadratic form. And of course, it's trivial, in quotes, to solve this, making Bogdanov transformation and introduce quasi-particles. And this order parameter phi c, then, I've defined this thing here. And one can generalize this for an inhomogeneous gas, of course, also, is the Cooper pair amplitude. Okay, they're all condensed in the same state. I might make a point, which I'll come back to later, is that this mean field approximation, a la Gorkov, or Bogdanov-Gorkov, BCS-Gorkov, I have a whole bunch of names here, only includes the Cooper pairs to the extent they're both condensed. The BCS theory in its standard form does not talk about Cooper pairs out of the condensate with finite center of mass momentum. They're all in some sense in the uniform system at Q equals zero. But in fact, in these new things, as we'll see, for the first time we can actually study Cooper pairs out of the condensate.
Well, in principle, you could just create metal, you could supply a current.
No, that's not what I mean. It's simply redefining what you mean by the condensate. You still never deal with atoms out of the condensate. You simply redefine your topological state.
So that those are then states with center of mass. Right?
Yes, yes.
You know,
but
the former statement is that there's only one eigenvalue of the two-particle density matrix, which has a macroscopic eigenvalue. That's the only one which corresponds to bound state.
Right. Tony's trying to get me here. but in any event, another way of saying it is that a moving supercurrent, of course, is that we simply introduce a new topological state, which is a Bose condensate. All the Cooper pairs are moving with the same momentum. In other words, Bose condensation is not, say, in Q equals zero, but some finite value of Q. What I'm talking about is what Einstein talked about in that previous slide, is you can, of course, have Cooper pairs, which you can have in these gases. Cooper pairs, you know, bound states, which are not in the condensate. They're like molecules out of the condensate.
Those are not the U's and the V's in the Bobillard.
Nothing, no, no. BCS theory, U's and V's, and completely ignore any, in fact, even the question doesn't arise there. All the Cooper pairs, by definition, are always Bose condensed. Now, anyway, that previous Hamiltonian, of course, can be solved in terms of the famous quasiparticles, and we have this famous quasiparticle gap. And it's interesting, it really goes back to Tony, this is say t equals zero, in the 80s, that it's going to be interesting when we discuss the BCS-BEC crossover. The quasiparticle spectrum, the Fermi spectrum, is always given by this result within the mean field Gorkov approximation. Although it's very important from the point of view of experimentalists, which I don't know if we have any in the audience here, but it's very important for experimentalists to realize, of course, experimentalists, when they're measuring atoms, have to remember that all these calculations are always done relative to the chemical potential, the energies. So it's very important to remember that if this is the excitation energy, the quasiparticle, the atom, okay, that you might study, of course, has energy mu plus the quasiparticle energy at momentum Q. And one of the key things we'll find, let me just mention later in the BCS-BEC crossover, is in the BCS region, mu is positive. Of course, in the extreme limit, mu is simply equal to the Fermi energy, as we all know, in extreme limit, which we're not really interested here. But when we go through the crossover, mu changes sign and becomes positive, or becomes negative, and therefore you immediately see, for example, when mu is negative, the energy gap of the excitations and also the atoms is no longer given by delta, but in fact, it's really given by delta squared plus mu squared. Anyway, so this is all a review. I haven't got to my talk yet.
You're still calling the quasiparticles here the fermions, right?
Yeah.
So when you say that last relation was the relation between one quasiparticle energy and one fermion energy, right? One fermi atom.
This last one here? Yeah. I mean, this is just the energy, but in fact, the atom is really a linear combination of you know, creating and destroying two of these excitations and all this sort of stuff, which is important to remember when you make contact with some experimentalist who's actually studying atoms. Okay.
But I guess it's a little confusing since you talk about the energy of an atom and give it a mu, but then the E's you have are really for, as you say, these composite objects. And so you have to be a little careful with the bookkeeping on the mu, to make sure that reflects the particle content of the excitation in general.
No. What you're asking is, this is the energy of the atom. What the question where the U's and V's come in are the strength. If you work out the single particle spectral density of the atoms, you have to take into account what's the amplitude of these things. All I'm trying to say, because it caused us trouble, and I think it's recently caused Jason trouble, is that you got to remember excitations. And atoms are real atoms, have this mu here, and in particular when mu changes sign, you have to watch this. This will come back later when we do calculations.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is you should do the bookkeeping consistently on whether you're working with these BCS composite objects or with atoms.
Yeah.
And so you may, in some circumstances, as I guess Tony and Takagi first pointed out for the helium 3 context, there was an effective particle number associated with the excitations, which will come in with the mu.
Okay, well, I'm not quite familiar with this paper you're referring to. But we've done, I can guarantee we've done our bookkeeping right. Now,
we're just trying to understand it.
Yeah. Anyway, now the BCS-BEC crossover. Let us go further into the jungle. Having caused confusion in the Feshbach resonance, a lot of questions about BCS. Now we're going to proceed to the third topic, the BCS-BEC crossover, as worked out way a long time ago. Anyway, so with a real attractive interaction between fermions, just increase its strength, bring the bottom of the little square well potential, say, down, you will find that the S-wave scattering length, which at these low temperatures is the only partial wave that's important, actually changes sign. No Feshbach resonance yet, okay? So this is, in the latest jargon, this is what would be called the one-channel problem, okay? So the Cooper pairs become more and more tightly bound, that is, and as a result, get smaller. And eventually you go over to the famous BEC region of small Cooper pair molecules, and in the limit, it's simply you reproduce Bogli-Boggs theory.
Is small and large relative to inner particle spacing? Is that what you're
saying? Yes, because it, yeah. Now, it's interesting. This was first introduced in a paper which I remember looking at, because Tony brought everybody's attention to that, in 1969, and I think in connection with some exotic condensed matter system of ferroelectric or something. Yeah, and I remember looking at it initially and thinking, oh, that's sort of funny and all that sort of stuff. And Tony is very nice about giving references to earlier people, so I always sort of ignored it. But so in recent papers, I often said, well, these ideas were really started up again by Leggett, who did the work at T equals zero, and Nozier and Schmidt-Rink, who extended this ideas to TC, taking into account that in, as I'll mention, at TC, it's quite different than the usual BCS theory, because TC in these systems, in the crossover region, corresponds to taking Cooper pairs out of the molecules out of the condensate, rather than breaking them apart in the standard BCS theory. And of course, what's interesting is crossover, even though that's often not emphasized, is the spectral weight of the Fermi spectrum, of course, decreases, because increasingly, not only is the dispersion relation changing, but their weight is changing, because, of course, the atoms are more and more forming Cooper pairs. Anyway, this is just a little picture that we're all familiar with of Hausmann.
Is it more accurate to say the spectral weight is shifted to very high frequencies, very high energy, the order of the dissociation?
Yes, that could be a way of putting it. Yeah. Oops, going backward here. I might just make a comment here, which is that I recently got a nice email message from, I guess, Dr. Eagles. I don't know if Tony has got messages from Dr. Eagles. Pointing out to me that I had ignored his work when in some, and given undue credit to Leggett and Nozier, and that he actually even sent me a copy in by post. He lives somewhere in southern England or something like this. And I have the feeling that perhaps Dr. Eagles has been waiting around for years, waiting for this whole subject to become popular again. But he certainly does get credit, because basically he did this, the first crossover stuff. But anyway, very correctly pointed out that even though I had referred to it in an earlier book, he says, you, as many other people, and I criticize other people, apparently have not read my paper. And it's only recently I read his paper.
Where was it published?
In Physical Review.
Well, what was the reference to Hausmann in
1993? Oh, well, this Hausmann, I call attention to the fact, has a very nice book on this subject, the entire book. But he was a student of Zweiger. Zweiger at... And I think it was quite a brilliant student. Oh, of course, this is all, I'm being taped here, but quite a brilliant student, but I think disappeared, was sort of, for instance, Zweiger was very involved in all this stuff, but Hausmann asked him not to be on the paper, he said, because he had made no contributions, stuff like that, you know, sort of. Anyway, Hausmann has disappeared. But it's a very nice book, Verlag, and I strongly encourage any of you to try to get a copy of it. Several papers. Yeah.
More than just the letter.
No, very, very careful account. It's a very nice book. It's very good. I'm sure this book didn't sell any copies for many, many years, and there's suddenly a little run on it. Maybe 10 people want it now.
So what is the book?
I could give. It's referred to in our. It's referred to. If you read our papers, you'll see references to it. I got you there. Okay. Now let me actually discuss the work in the early 90s of Randeria and postdocs and students, or I guess students at the time, who I guess were attached to Tony. I noticed in a recent papers often this comes out as Sade rather than Sa de Mello. You know, it's, you know, Marquise de Sade.
I think I've seen that.
Is it? Yeah. But in any event, so they did this problem, and they introduced this scattering length, you know, for this, remember, one channel problem. And this is reviews the standard results for TC, for instance, which actually have to go past, as I'll mention, BCS, because you have to include fluctuations that BCS doesn't include. And this, unfortunately, I do this in different limits. Here, this is now the BEC region, and this is the BCS region. Okay, so this line, this curve here, TC is a function of TF, basically. as a here is minus, okay, it's attractive, AS is negative. So this would be the BCS theory, and initially people thought it was just you're going to get very high TCs, but in fact what's happening is the molecules are forming, the Cooper pairs are becoming, I should say, they form, but the question is, are they long-lived and how long they are long-lived, but eventually become stabilized, infinitely long-lived. And then you go over to the Bose gas. In fact, Hausmann did a lot of work on this famous little peak here. It's generally viewed this peak, although some people put great stress on it, is this due to not doing a careful treatment in the Feshbach region, which is when AS becomes infinite, and therefore 1 over KF AS is 0. Okay, but this is for a uniform gas, and this is the famous 0.218. And this formula here, which the calculations give, this formula, this point here, of course, was first worked out by Einstein in 1925. Yeah.
But you would expect the slope or curvature to be positive at the BCN, which you are rather generally going.
That's an interesting point.
Well, if you take the Petrov Simon Schlattenkopf result,
Yeah. The only thing is at least that's an interesting point for the two-channel problem, but for the one-channel problem, that's one of the places where it might be different. In a sense, it'd be interesting for Petrov et al. Don't you work with Petrov, Jar?
Sorry?
Don't you work with Petrov?
Petrov worked with me.
But in any event, to do their sort of stuff, to discuss the one-channel problem and the question of just when you have Cooper pairs and, in some sense, in quotes, no real molecules, whatever that means, whether or not that still holds. I might say in these calculations, both in 93 and also a later paper in 97, they also, of course, worked out, just by inspection, they worked out the fact that this is, of course, is the phase diagram, but they worked out the collective modes, the excitations in this limit. Here, of course, the collective modes, you have fermions. Of course, when you're going through this thing, what's happening is the fermion degrees of freedom are being squashed, okay? Or, as Tony says, go to high energy. And what's happening is the collective modes, here you have the famous Anderson-Bogliubov collective mode, and it's slowly going into the Bogliubov phonon mode. And when you got over here, when they worked out the dispersion relation, they found out it was phonon-like, and then just by inspection noted that exactly the phonon velocity of the Bose condensed gas of Cooper pairs here corresponded to the famous factor of 2, I mean 2 times AS rather than 0.6. But it'd be interesting to check whether or not that 0.6 is also valid in this problem. But
yes, it is.
It is, okay, good.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course.
Okay.
You know, just this 0.6a, mm-hmm. forget about Feshbach resonances.
Yeah.
It's simply confusing people. Assume that there is just a weakly bound state just below the continuum, and there is a very large positive scattering there. And do the calculation. Mm-hmm. And this will be the case of white Feshbach resonance, which they have in the experiment now. And please let me make this Friday or coming Friday next week, give me an informal seminar on this.
Okay.
Can you
do it next week?
Yes, I can. I'm here all the time.
But I might say this all this analysis, just like our work, like we now understand, courtesy of Petrov and Schlattenkopf. Oh yeah, but
just a short comment because Tony mentioned. You know, these two A of Randeria, etc. By the way, neither you nor Schmidtring used to A. You don't write that.
No,
Randeria does. Yeah. Yes, this is just the first born amplitude,
yeah.
First born approximation. And then, if you do it correctly, then you will see that the sound velocity of your molecular condensate, this BEC side, will be by a factor of 2 smaller than the one that people calculated.
No, but I think now we understand, courtesy of the work of Jorah and his collaborators and also Strinati, we now understand that, you know, basically all the...
Strinati's wrong, by the way.
Well, I don't know. I was talking to your Petrov, and he says Strinati is right. In a sense, what I meant in the following sense, one knows the type of diagrams one has to include, okay, past the mean field approximation in these theories now to actually produce the 0.6.
Yes.
Okay. I don't do it, but I know how to do it.
I'm going to tell you now what I told you yesterday at lunch. people who do diagrammatic approaches without having a small parameter, they do, they write diagrammatic series, then they cut them at some point, calculate something, and then say, this is the result.
Yeah.
And then, as we discussed with Trinaki people, if they were writing all diagrammatic series exactly, then these diagrammatic series are reduced to our equation in the coordinates.
Yeah, no, I agree that they came, in some sense, their discussion is not as elucidating as yours. But I'm just saying, as now, as of today, we now understand how I could improve Randeria's discussion, or how I could improve what I'm going to later discuss, to get the correct interaction, repulsive interaction between the bosons, which wasn't clear at that time, with the diagrammatic approach. I can show you the diagrams. Well, yeah, but yeah, okay. In any event, that's this result here. Just for experimentalists, even though none of you are, one of the things is experimentally, you see, you go from this Bose region nowadays along here from studying collective modes and what have you. And it's very interesting. I just want to comment here about this dashed line. This dashed line, T star, is in some sense the transition line, if you want to call it, where the Cooper pairs are actually being busted apart. This line here is essentially the Cooper pairs being excited, just like helium atoms getting out of the condensate. So quite different physics. But T star is really the temperature at which the Cooper pairs themselves break up, okay? Not just go into states of finite momentum. And as a result, just 1 minute, and as a result, when you go across here, you could easily, when you're trying to probe the so-called BCS region that many groups, experimental groups are doing, you could easily, in fact, This region here is not so exciting, in fact, but you could easily bump into this dotted line, and maybe some of the work of Grimm and what have you, in fact, this very anomalous damping, what have you, is picking up the effects of this T star. That's just a side remark.
Is TC a thermodynamic transfer? What is
TC? TC here?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the temperature of when the order parameter vanishes. That when delta, remember that phi C, the Cooper pair amplitude vanishes. That determines TC. It's a new phase of, that describes the phase of matter.
Presumably it's a second order phase transition.
At this, at the level I'm working at, it's strictly, it's completely just BCS. That's what's interesting. The Randeria work, building on Leggett's and also the work of Nozier and Schmidt-Rink, basically, all have the structure of a BCS-like theory. The order parameter has that same structure and all this sort of stuff. That doesn't mean we can't improve that, but that's the basic physics.
You can write the BCS wave function, and it will also nicely describe you the molecule. And if you work out in the one-dimensional case, which is an exactly solvable model with the vertical trans, you clearly see that. The question of mine is, who knows for sure that the curve of TC looks like you plotted? Why doesn't it go lower and so on?
Yeah.
Why there is this bump over there?
Well, as I say, better calculations, particularly going back to the work of Hausmann, get rid of this hump here in this particular problem. The second thing is, experimentally, the current experiments disagree with these predictions.
Now, there has to be maximum general ground.
Yeah.
Assume the scattering length is positive on the right-hand side.
Yeah, Yeah, but the question is there a wee little bumper or what?
I'm not talking about the scattering, I'm talking about the
scattering. Yeah. I'm going to continue, because here's something, because I want to really advertise this old work.
I want you to teach me. And I have a pleasure to ask you.
As long as you're good, as long as the clock's not ticking on my dog. Sure.
You said that the order parameter disappears, that this gap. But isn't it such that if I calculate the gap, then I go through the resonance to the BEC side, on the BEC side, the gap is just the binding energy of the molecule?
Related to that,
So then what disappears at this?
Well, it's related to that, but the question is whether or not you have a coherent state, a Bose condensation of these things. You can have the molecules in the BEC side that form that have not formed a Bose condensate yet. Okay, so. Well, yeah.
Just that a general definition, if you like, mm-hmm. which will cover the whole range, is that TC is the locus of the vanishing of the macroscopic eigenvalue of the two particle density.
Yeah. Okay.
So
you calculate
two body density.
Right. Okay. In any event, I want to just popularize this old work of Randeria and his co-workers because they're very useful papers, which I had looked at many years ago when I was working on this, but it's only recently I've gone back to them. And this is a nice thing I got out here, which is in their theory, this is again 1 over KFAS, you know, so this is the BEC side, and this is the BCS side. And here, what they're, let me not worry about, I want to worry about the dotted dashed line here. The dashed line is KF times the size of the pair, okay? The size of the pair, the size of this little bound state that's Bose condensing, okay? And you see, as you see through the crossover, the dashed line just smoothly goes down. That is, and this is, these are both, this is a log, log scale. So basically what's happening, you're going for very large Cooper pairs here. This is the result of their calculations, to smaller and smaller, but very smooth through the crossover point, the resonance point, and getting smaller and smaller as we continue along. So that's the picture within this one channel problem. That is, the dashed line shows a smooth decrease in the size of the bound state pair as we go from BCS to BEC. And the question is, ultimately, when we deal with the two-channel model, is there a distinction between this, which is this Cooper pair, and of course the molecule, and I'm going to argue there's not too much distinction, at least in terms of the model I'm making, although maybe in some extended model, there might be a distinction between the the real molecule and the Cooper pair. One of the things that I just mentioned here also, let's see, yeah, you might ask, well, how did they define this pair? Well, that's essentially the expectation value they take of the kinetic energy of the pair, like in other words, Laplacian, you know, square, a Laplacian, of the BCS wave function in this region, and it goes, I forget what it goes delta over 2EF or something like that. So this is this sort of thing in the BCS region. This is a standard textbook calculation of the size of the Cooper pair, and you see KF times the size of the pair is very, very large.
And what is psi zero?
That's the black line. That's related to a correlation length, which is quite a different thing. The correlation length has this minimum here. I've not really sort of looked at that. That's something that, so that's not the size of the pair. Okay, the size of the pair is defined, as I say, the wave function and in some sense the spatial extent. This other one, chi, zeta zero there, is a correlation length.
I thought that's the size of the pair.
Well, it's not. In BCS limit, you notice they are, but a deviation here. So it's that aspect is something you could study today. Now, let's go on to our last topic. Putting all this together in a specific model that can address all this different physics, namely so-called nowadays in the jargon, the two-channel model. So basically, to discuss all these problems, we need a microscopic model that includes the two-body physics of the Feshbach resonance, and which allows, in some sense, at that level, real molecules to form. We need a theory that can deal with the forming of Cooper pairs, which are also, in some sense, molecules, but due to many body effects. And we want to be able to deal with this crossover. And essentially, the two-channel model that I'll discuss, and which many theorists have discussed in the last year or two, has actually a fairly long tradition, I think, in kinetic matter physics, partly in connection with high TC. But it was popularized or brought to the attention of the AMO community by very important papers by Timmermans and collaborators, and also Murray Hall and the collaborators, that said this type of coupled fermion boson model would be a nice model to attack all these problems, in, at least in a consistent fashion. Namely, explicitly includes the Fermi atoms, the bosonic dimers formed from these atoms, and the Feshbach resonance coupling term to them, and it's the starting Hamiltonian for your many-body calculations. Yeah?
Somehow,
yeah.
This model, boson model, is replacing the macroscopic guiding value of the two-body density matrix by a model where instead you have a macroscopic eigenvalue of a one-body bosonic density matrix. And the question is, how good is that approximation?
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that.
Does anybody know how to do this? No, this is where they have good bosons of ordinary molecules, right? Oppenheimer and
But you know, in the part B CD, where the size of a molecule is much smaller than the
Of course, then it's fine.
Now, in this, let me, we've seen this many times, but at least this is my version, notation. So epsilon Q0, this describes, of course, of our sigma, of course, spin up and spin down, our two hyperfine states. There are two Fermi gases, let's say, filled up, and this here is maybe not too clear, is two epsilon F, because that's what counts, as we'll see. Then we have, because we're making pairs, then we have the kinetic energy of the molecule, that's simply Q squared over 2m, where m is twice the mass of the fermions. And 2 nu, as I say, is the bottom of this energy. Say the molecule wasn't moving, it had an energy 2 nu. Okay? And I'm going to call those the B bosons. So we have our, so this term and this term is our usual BCS expression. Now we're, in this model, introducing these bosons, and also introducing a coupling which allows the bosons to decay, like you could, for instance, destroy two fermions at these momenta and create a boson, or you can have the Hermitian conjugate where you destroy, you can have either this process here, which describes this, or it's Hermitian conjugate where a boson decays into two states, spin up and spin down. My strength here is GRR is just to describe resonance. Anyway, yep.
You haven't told us what the boson composition.
No, and I'm not. I'm not aggressively. I'm not, because that's a separate question. But important.
Are you implicitly assuming that both the spin states of both the fermions that go to form the boson are different from those of the two original? So both atoms in different spin states.
I'm not explicitly. As I said to Oriol Boljak a couple of weeks ago, I've not thought about that. I don't know what I've done there, because I don't think it's at this level. But in some sense, right at the end of the talk, I will discuss in some sense, try to unpack what I mean by B, like a better theory of B, in terms of is B, like as, let me just briefly comment on it right now, is B though, for instance, to be thought of as a dimer of, just like a Cooper pair, in fact, this molecule, because we know right at resonance, which is the interesting region, that when you actually work out the energy of this bound state, it's almost entirely composed of, you can understand it as involving mainly atoms that is spin up and spin down in the so-called open channel. And in that case, then the molecule looks very much like a Cooper pair, in the sense the Cooper pair is between the opposite guys. Or does it involve another hyperfine state, which is different than spin up and spin down?
Can I?
Yeah.
Make a comment here? Because it seems to me that I mean, normally what one does is say that you have, say, a pair of hyperfine states, alpha, beta, and you may have, let's imagine we have two others, gamma and delta, just to be explicit. Now, normally, when one writes down these two channels things, what one does is to say, well, we have projection operators that just take up everything here in one channel, everything here in the other. Now, a more physically meaningful way to do it is, in fact, to say, not only say we take the atoms in these channels here, but we also restrict the momenta that we're talking about in this channel, and also call this thing the open channel with just some particular low momentum or not particularly high momentum cutoff.
Sorry, Chris, what are alpha?
These are just labels for atomic hyperfine states.
So
they represent spin up and spin down.
Talking about two atoms.
In the case of two.
Total angular momentum, including nucleus.
Yeah, so in the case of, let's take potassium 40, then the states that Heavy Jim has worked with, say, minus 9 half, minus with the projection of minus 9/2 mixed up with 9/2 minus 7/2. Okay?
That's the asymptotic open channel stuff.
These are the single atoms.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
those are alpha and beta.
Yeah.
Those
yeah.
For example. Yeah. Now, for simplicity, in this case in potassium 40, the only thing you can mix with is keeping the total projection the same, and the other total spin you can get is 7/2. So you've got to, in fact, go to one which is the same. And the only other thing you can do is change the total label here to minus 7/2. So this is the example I was referring to the other week, Tony, where there is one common hyperfine state in both channels.
Yeah.
Now, in fact, the molecules are not really purely in this channel. They're in a superposition of this and this. Mm-hmm. And so the physically meaningful way to make a separation is to pull out the atoms with, say, some low momentum, and then call all the rest the other cutoff, including the high energy stuff with these quantum numbers. I mean, normally people talk about singlets and triplets with the electronic spin and spin, and forget about the nuclear spin.
Yeah.
But because of the hyperfine coupling, the incoming atoms are not in a singlet or a triplet. They're coupled to the nuclear spins, and so you've got some mixture of singlets and triplets. And so generally, those spin states are not orthogonal to those of the molecule.
No, it's not.
You know, Chris, I think that doesn't matter. Yes, what you first do, you say, let me forget about the hyperfine interaction between two potential curves. Let me construct the adiabatic potential curve. And that's what people do, yes? And then you couple these two potential curves with the hyperfine interaction. And that's what everybody does.
Yeah, but the problem is that gives you completely wrong predictions for what the magnetic moment of the molecules.
If you couple correctly, then it doesn't.
So I think it's very confusing. Yes. Just.
I guess I agree with everything Chris said. And one of the implications is that because of this, the fact that one of the two hyperfine states is identical in the two channels, the BQs cannot formally be regarded as independent operators. And I do think you have to worry about it.
Well, that's why I say, but I think if you look at. I'd like to try and make some momentum projection now.
What you're not allowed to ask questions, Jason.
But
the thing is, what these questions are really addressing, I think, very important questions which need to be clarified, is really the legitimacy of this thing in the red box, namely this Hamiltonian that many theorists have been working on. It's just that's an aspect I still think, just forgetting about these things and keep on going into the forest, it's interesting just to work with this, and let's keep in the back of our mind, we have to come back and sort of unpack what we mean by B, or as Tony says, maybe some sort of, there might be some, we have to really understand carefully the Hilbert space in some sense of the B operators and the C operators, because the B operators certainly are supposed to be made up of by this sort of thing here. The B operators are made up of combining, you know, two of these states. I mean, Dr. Hohn was saying, I mean, these would be, say, alpha and beta, or spin up and spin down. Yeah. But I want to sort of just study the structure of this Hamiltonian.
I'll just comment that there are cases, although rather unusual cases, where you have this sort of double spin to get into the interposed chapter.
Sorry?
You have a double spin to get into the closed chapter. In other words, both your states are different. And for that, I think formally, your description looks
really good.
Alan, could you say where the Fischbach resonance is in this? Is it in GR?
In this, yeah, GR.
GR goes to infinity formally?
No, GR is can be large, can be small, but it's basically,
excuse me, but I understood that GR is just atomic coupling.
Yeah. It's the vertex function that describes when two atoms come together to form the molecule. It's a way of talking about the Feshbach resonance in terms of a Hamiltonian, this corpus. Well, this is a point which, but probably independent of any other question, what would be very useful. And I guess there are some literature by Hank Stolf and other people where they try.
Gentlemen,
yeah.
And chairman of this session.
Yeah.
I claim myself chairman. I would like to say that let the speaker give his talk. Let us just listen to the speaker.
No. I'm learning too. Yeah. But in any event, one of the points that's bad about this test.
I'm addressing the chairman since I was not allowed to ask. Am I allowed to repeat what Alan wants to say? I'm not asking questions.
Only afterwards.
Yeah. It'll cost you, Jason. But the point is, it's very useful to make an extended version of this Hamiltonian, I think, where one really explicitly puts in some parameterization of the size of, you know, the wave function of the molecule. Here, we're just saying we've got a molecule B, and we're not really saying what its size is in real space, some sort of a form factor or something like this.
But it is fixed and it doesn't do anything funny.
No, that's true. In any event, in terms of this language, you can immediately see that, and of course everything's to be determined, the so-called broad and narrow resonances are determined by the value of G. If G is very, very small, you can see this is going to be a perturbation, but also you can see, in that case, energetically, you can immediately see that when two, independent of the kinetic energy of the molecules, that soon as 2 nu here drops down to 2 ef, it's clear, of course, this sort of process will start to be efficient. In other words, if gr is very small, you're going to only form molecules when 2 nu is approaching 2 ef. And of course, 2 nu is the thing that we assume is the variable in this language that we're adjusting in the Feshbach resonance when we're changing the magnetic field, in some sense viewing that as the, we can adjust this energy of the molecule. Here, the molecule, you could say, is, in the way I've drawn it, is a resonant state of the Fermi gas. But as soon as 2 nu is less than 2 epsilon f, you can form it. As soon as 2 nu becomes negative, okay, and you go into the BEC region, then you can see in a simplest picture that these would become sort of stabilized molecules, because once you form the molecules, they don't have enough energy, if you're dealing with a narrow resonance, to decay back into fermions. Of course, if GR is very large, then in some sense it's like a very broad spectrum where, in fact, even if 2 nu is very large, you can, in fact, couple in and also, well, okay.
What is the energy which you need to compare with EA to determine whether it's,
you know,
wide or narrow?
That's sort of I would think I should know the answer to that question, but I don't have a simple thing. But it's clear that two energies are 2 epsilon f or 2 nu. Okay, and what? And if when gr is much bigger than e epsilon f, then it's definitely a broad resonance. And when g is less than e f, it's a narrow resonance. Yeah, yeah.
Because it's something like g squared times the density of space.
Yeah,
yeah. Without g to the fourth. I mean, actually, I don't.
Because you can do that with perturbation theory.
An effective low energy G, then you can make an energy out of that, which is G to the fourth. Because if I look at a damping rate, then there's a G squared times the density of states in the three dimensions, that goes like energy to the half. So G squared with H bars and M's gives me an energy to the half. So there's an energy scale, which is G to the fourth. And so this is basically the thing that was related to Dimitrov's 1/(1)) effective range squared.
But do you have a specific answer to Tony's question? What's the defining, there's a parameter that determines it?
It depends on whether this is large or small compared with EFM. Yep.
May I?
Yeah, okay.
I think the description is rather simple. This model at resonance, all the action comes in here. This the scattering length, S-wave scattering length, will be in this model, will be given by GR squared divided by mu. So make the minus sign there, so it can be positive and negative. Now this is the energy. This would be the dimension of energy times length. So one could define, for example, that one power of r, and this would sufficient to define this length. And then one also, all one needs to do is either compare, look at this new gas parameter, whether it is less than one or bigger than one, or one could look at, as Chris said, then look at the ratio as this energy r squared divided by EF, which is amounts to, depending on whether it's bigger and larger than the one. And the Gila number turns out to be way in this limit, and also the MIT. And so
in terms of G, what's the criterion on G?
G would be.
Forget about R star.
You can let me.
Well, no, but anyway, we could get it from your formula.
If G is the form of EF, something like that.
This has to be less than one.
Has to be much less than one.
Yeah.
For narrow.
That's useful.
What?
I'll think
why?
About that.
No, the other way around.
For Y resonance.
Anyway, I'm going to proceed. So anyway, just this is just elementary physics. One of the things that kind of make, I think we've made an important contribution though, is this finite lifetimes, which often in simple theories people don't worry about. Anyway, molecules, as we'll see in this stuff, start to form when 2 nu is less than 2 epsilon f. This language is the narrow resonance. And of course, we'll not be able to decay when 2 nu is less than 0. This is narrow resonance, different conditions for the broad resonance. Now, of course, we know in this problem, because we're talking about the total number of fermions in this model, of course, it allowing for the fact that bosons may appear. Of course, this thing, there might be no bosons. The expectation value might be zero. But anyway, we have the sum of the free fermions and the sum of the number of bosons. And of course, we have a factor of 2 because each boson eats up 2 fermions. So this is the formal definition of NF and NB. Okay. And one can also analyze, when we're worrying about Cooper pairs, in some sense, Cooper pairs are buried in this part, in fact. Turns out. Anyway, a crucial feature of this Hamiltonian is that there's only one chemical potential, okay? Simply because the B molecules are formed from the Fermi atoms, so that the boson chemical potential actually just turns out to be twice the Fermi chemical potential, but that's misleading. So, because even though the determination of mu is the absolute crucial part of the problem going through this resonance, and the mu that we'll be talking about is the chemical potential of the fermions, it's very important to remember that it's actually, you know, twice mu is the chemical potential of the bosons, and in some sense, that's a better way of thinking about it. So this coupled Hamiltonian we see modifies the effect of the two-body Feshbach resonance. And now the two atoms are, in some sense, when you analyze this, as we'll see, are now part of an interacting system. And it's the presence of this Phil Fermi C and Pauli statistics and all this sort of stuff is going to be buried in the many-body treatment of this. Now, in the simplest approximation to that somewhat suspect Hamiltonian, we're going to just do the famous Bienfield-Gorkov approximation, generalizing what we did, but allowing now for Cooper pairs and a Bose condensate. So the original Hamiltonian that I had written down there just a few minutes ago there, what we're going to do is do, just as we did with this part here, a BCS pairing involving C or C star or expect broken symmetry of this. Here we're going to take a broken symmetry of this and a broken broken symmetry expectation value of the B operators, allowing for the fact that these things are conform Bose condensates. So in this mean field approximation, which should be good in the usual language at t equals zero, when there's no fluctuations, no atoms or molecules out of the ground of the condensate, we're just allowing for this anomalous broken symmetry type term. So our interacting Fermi gas Hamiltonian minus mu n, where that's the total number of fermions, now comes out to be this. This is the usual energy of the fermions. Now phi m here, of course, is simply the expectation value of B, okay? And it's phi m squared. And so we're ignoring all the molecules with finite center mass momentum. This is the usual thing that I introduced before, the BCS Cooper pair condensate. But now this Feshbach coupling term now involves phi m. So this phi m, I say, is the expectation value of the molecules with q equals zero. I'm writing it here in for a uniform system in terms of momentum, but a lot of our calculations are done for the trap case. Okay, so this is the Hamiltonian we have, and we immediately see, of course, that you could solve this by Bogle-Lyubov transformation, because the Cooper pair guys are here, these guys, but they're simply C star, C star, C star, C star, so we can diagonalize this. So you immediately see, in fact, without anything further, that while you might be expecting really two types of condensates, in some sense, a Cooper pair condensate and a molecular condensate, in fact, the theory will involve a BCS, the solution to this, will involve a new composite order parameter, which I'm going to discuss more in detail in the next slide, which is simply just read through. It's minus U phi C minus, in the way minus signs are defined, minus G phi M. So basically, the new composite order parameter is actually a superposition of the two Bose condensates, the Cooper pair condensate and the molecular condensate. But once you do that, everything that you're familiar with in BCS theory goes through, of course, except now delta tilde is given by this, and of course, it's crucial to calculate phi C and phi M self-consistently.
But now you'll need two self-consistently.
Is G the same as GR?
GR, yes, excuse me. Yeah. I use GR because G is often used for the interaction between molecules, but G is GR on all this stuff. Okay. Now, so let me just comment about this composite order parameter. I mean, this composite order parameter, which is simply the natural generalization of the one-channel problem, is now we've got effectively one order parameter involving these two guys. And one of the things initially that you might think, well, gee, and in fact, in our work a couple of years ago, we thought, well, we've got two types of molecules, two types of order parameters. But you can show, I think, fairly generally in terms of that Hamiltonian, the starting Hamiltonian, that phi m and phi c, when I say fairly general, within, you know, mean field, you know, off-diagonal order parameters, that phi m and phi c are related to each other. If you know phi m, you know phi c, and if you know phi c, you know phi m by this relation here. Okay. This 2 mu coming in here, of course, is crucial. That's a medium effect due to the fact you're dealing with a many-body problem. You notice that if you're somehow dealing with, well, okay, so that 2 mu is very important coming in. So in any event, this order parameter, I think it's useful in more recent language to think of it as the pair wave function. And you can see it's got the open scattering channel, this guy here, involving regular Cooper pairs. And in some sense, you can view this as the closed or molecular channel, you know, the guy involving the molecules. Okay, the number of Bose condensed, just 1 minute, Sam. The number of Bose condensed B molecules is simply given, of course, by the absolute square of phi m. Okay, that's the number of B bosons, which, of course, you have to compute self-consistently in this theory. The number of Cooper pairs you have, it turns out, is not so easy to calculate. It's quite amusing, and those of you who are in BCS know BCS theory, the number of Cooper pairs, you almost never, ever ask that question in condensed matter physics, and it's sort of more of a subtle question to calculate the number of Cooper pairs, but it can be done, and we've done it.
Before you do it, you have to define.
What? Yeah. Well, the Cooper pairs are the things described by phi c.
How do you get that big blue box? You minimize the Hamiltonian. It looks like
you minimize the Hamiltonian.
Because phi m appears quadratic and linear with phi c coupled into it.
Yeah.
So if you minimize that with respect to phi m, you look as if you get that kind of relation.
But you can see anybody who knows BCS theory, once you get this Hamiltonian, everything proceeds through, except everything now has to be calculated self-consistently. And remember, and this theory doesn't include the fluctuations. So this theory is good at t equals zero. But as soon as you have to allow for the fact that the B molecules might not be in the Bose condensed state, there might be a thermal cloud of B molecules, and there might be a thermal cloud of Cooper pairs, okay? Unknown in condensed matter physics, a thermal cloud of Cooper pairs, then of course you have to include fluctuations, which, you know, pass the mean field, and we've done that. And that was first done in the one-channel problem by Randeri.
Okay, the only thing is, I don't understand what that is.
Well, I know. I mean, you're just going to have to bear with me. In any event...
Have you done the case where you allow interactions between the molecules?
Well, it's very interesting. Let me see. Keep on going back here. But let's just go back to the starting Hamiltonian. And a lot of this discussion, of course, is the significance of the Hamiltonian. It's interesting that this thing just allows molecules to, in some sense, molecules to be created or destroyed, okay? And I know initially we thought one of the things we were doing calculations to include other terms in the Hamiltonian would describe how two molecules interact, you know, like a B star B and B star B and what have you, and also how molecules and atoms would interact, collisions. In other words, not processes that create or destroy them. And it's only in the last couple of months I've realized, particularly discussing with Petrov, is that this type of coupling term is sufficient, for instance, if you work with it to higher order, to get all the interactions apparently between molecules. I wonder if somebody could put the light on. You know, let me just mention, say, for instance, this type of, we've not included in the mean field, but we could. Say you have a molecule, it can decay into two fermions. Then these two fermions can produce a molecule. Okay, so these are fermions and these are molecules. And then similarly, we can have a guy like this that a molecule comes out, two fermions are annihilated. So each of these points here are G. And I guess maybe that's a G4. And then finally, we have a molecule here that is coming in. So immediately you see you can actually work out, and you know, for instance, the effect of this diagram. You know, what's the effective interaction between two molecules? Here's two molecules coming in, and there's two molecules coming out. And for instance, we've worked that out, and it's sort of quite amusing in terms of the Feshbach resonance. If this is 2 nu, and this is the BEC region here, or this is 0, and this is 2 nu, that in this type of theory, you find, as people have pointed out, that in this problem, in the extreme BEC limit, the effective interaction, A molecule-molecule, turns out to be, and say this value here, well, that it turns out to be 0 here, but in fact builds up as you approach the Feshbach resonance, just from this diagram here, where this would be one A Fermi, for instance. And the correct answer, as we know, is 0.6. But as Petrov has pointed out to me, that one knows now that other diagrams one has to include just from this interaction that will give rise to all of them. For instance, there's another one that looks like this, which where you have a fermion like this. What is it? It goes up let's see here. Well, there's maybe Ajora knows this one, but let's see. There's one here. There's one that goes up like the fermion here. There's a fermion here. There's a fermion here. There's a fermion there. And let's see, and I think...
It's basically solving the full body problem, right?
Yeah. Well, anyway, there's a diagram that's crucial. It's crucial that Strinati apparently forgot that diagram, and that's when he includes it. He goes from 0.75 to 0.6 and stuff like this. So to my surprise, it's wrong to actually, to answer your question, long-winded answer, which I don't like, but that apparently this interaction is sufficient if you go to enough higher order processes to get the real interaction.
You want to model the actual underlying system, which starts out with
sure. Yeah.
I would like to ask the following. Mm-hmm. No, I don't understand what these molecules are unless I'm in the BEC region.
Yeah.
If not, I have problems to understand what this is. Question.
Yeah.
I can use this Hamiltonian irrespective of the dimensionality of this. I can also use it in
only with this is mean field. Only with great dread do you use a mean field approximation.
I can do it in the interacting regime.
Okay.
The Wick interacting regime in 1D I can. But the 1D, on the other hand, is an exactly solvable model.
I can just
write down the wave function and work out all parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple question. If I do this approach in 1D. With all these B's, etc. Then how good it describes the situation? Because about 1B we know where.
Well, it's interesting. I think one of your former students, I think last year at Aspen, one of your former students, Peter Fedichev, was literally interested in working out that problem. I don't know if he ever did work out that problem, but just to do sort of a Feshbach resonance based on this thing in a one-dimensional system. And working with, I forget the Spanish fellow who I think was at this conference, was the guy from Basque. What? Miguel?
Miguel Cousins.
So you should ask Peter about that. In any event, what's interesting, for instance, in this composite order parameter, taking into account that knowing this, you get this. You can rewrite this composite order parameter strictly in terms of Cooper pairs with an effective interaction. And I'll come back to this. This effective interaction is the bare, remember, U being positive is corresponds to attractive here. U effective is a being positive corresponds to attractive. That essentially in BCS theory, then you're going to get a sort of Cooper pairs with no molecules, but just involving phi effective, where phi effective is now the original background term and this new induced effect due to the Feshbach resonance. And I'd say the physics, I think it's clear that the attractive interaction between the Fermi atoms and the open channel is now renormalized to U effective by resonant coupling to the B molecules in the closed channel. But in that sense, you can talk about then the discussion. I might say you could also, instead of writing in terms of phi c, you could invert it and write the composite order parameter strictly in terms of the molecular Bose condensate, phi m, where the no Cooper pairs seem to appear. This is simply because you're dealing with a case where the two bound states are strongly hybridized in some sense, and that's why phi c and phi m are related to each other. And as a result, it's sort of almost a matter of taste whether you want to talk about BCS Cooper pairs or in terms of a molecular BEC of molecules, and both sides of the resonance. I'm making comments here that are going to be shown by explicit calculations shortly to appear. People are often sort of maybe a little puzzled about this, and it's nice for those with background in BCS theory to just remind yourself. Basically, in this theory, one is describing using field theoretic techniques the fermions by Green's functions and of course the bound states in our model in terms of a Green's function of propagator describing the molecules. Again, for simplicity, I use the uniform language because it's sort of useful. So you have, for instance, d0q of omega describe the molecule. Of course, it's got energy E epsilon q0, that's the center of mass energy, plus its energy if it wasn't moving, and it's standard minus 2 mu here. And for coupling to Cooper pairs, which correspond at Q and omega equal to zero, the molecule propagator reduces to this, okay? So basically, that effective interaction that I was talking about here is nothing else but the exact analog of the interaction due to phonons and superconductivity, okay? At this level, the theory sort of starts to look like, if you want to formulate it, like an Alley-Eisenberg theory, that basically this effective interaction is resulting simply by the fact that fermions can, in some sense, excite and absorb bosons, and that gives rise to an attractive interaction. Of course, I might say in this little thing here, buried in all our calculations is something I've not included here, that the B molecule energy spectrum is not this bare spectrum, the zero here, but in fact is strongly modified, particularly at finite temperature, due to the fact that it's coupling to the so-called Cooper pair channel, and that gives rise to a self-energy of the molecule, and that plays a very crucial role when you're discussing at finite temperatures, which we've included. Okay. Now, of course, this is just quick here, but it's no surprise then that when you work out this theory in the mean field approximation, this renormalized energy gap, the thing I call delta, this coherent mixture of these two things, ends up with a BCS type of gap equation with an enhanced interaction. This is the new equation that describes the delta tilde throughout the crossover region, and you got this effective interaction here, but other than that, everybody recognizes that. And of course, the BCS spectrum now involves delta tilde. But of course, it's very crucial to remember this thing has got two things which have to be calculated very carefully. In particular, it involves mu here, that you have to calculate self-consistently, which is actually a fairly heavy calculation to do even for a uniform system. So mu, it's very important to remember, is very dependent on the value of this 2 nu, namely how far you are from the resonance.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
Surely you don't mean Ek, because Ek is positive, and that looks like it's going to vanish by symmetry, because epsilon minus mu.
Which one?
This side.
Which one here?
Don't you want PK?
Oh, this should be small epsilon K.
It should be epsilon minus mu, presumably, shouldn't it?
No, this is this is correct. Value? Yeah, yeah. This is EK, but EK here, so I guess this is right at TC, right?
No, where,
so epsilon K is EK then is epsilon K minus mu.
Well, no, it's the absent value. That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah. Well, so you might be right. You might be right. Yeah.
Otherwise,
yeah.
It's going to vanish by symmetry.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is the standard at this level. Of course. So I emphasize then we have to calculate the chemical potential and also the order parameter delta tilde in a self-consistent manner, okay? And we can do it in mean field, and that goes back to Eagles and Leggett. But of course, at finite temperatures, it's crucial to include fluctuations in this theory. And here, it's sort of complicated to maybe discuss this, but let me just, I'm not going to say this too much in detail, but now we have to worry about Cooper pairs outside the BCS condensate. And the first people who did to do that were Nozier and Schmidt-Rink in a famous paper in 1985. So they generalized the Randeria type, well, the Leggett type theory to TC, taking into account that the crucial thing was now, this is the one-channel problem, the Cooper pairs outside the BCS condensate. That is, your TC is a result of kicking all the Cooper pairs into finite momentum states, and finally, you've got no atoms or Cooper pairs left in the condensate. The B molecules outside the molecular condensate, Ohashi and I first did this in 2002 at TC, okay, by calculating this self-consistently. That is, we still stuck with a mean field type theory, but we tried to include the fluctuations in mu and delta tilde following Schmidt-Rink and Nozier. Both effects, that is, this effect and this effect, then were worked out below TC in the superfluid phase by Ohashi and me in 2003. And again, and then one can then calculate the number of B molecules in Cooper pairs has to be self-consistently calculated as a function of 2 nu. But I also re-emphasize to you now the Cooper pairs, when I write this down, there's a certain number of Cooper pairs at finite temperatures which are in the condensate, a certain number of Cooper pairs not in the condensate, thermal cloud, and similarly with the B molecules, a certain number Bose-condensed, a certain number not Bose-condensed. So it's quite a complicated calculation. But just as an example of the type of calculations we've done for, for uniform gas in our 2003 paper. Here's as a function of temperature normalized to TF. And this is, I think these are results for what would be called a weak resonance or a narrow resonance. So here's the, you might call it the Cooper pair contribution. Here's the BCS or the molecule contribution, and you see when two nu over two epsilon F is equal to two. So this is really in the BCS region already the molecules are making a contribution. When you go right at the resonance, namely nu is equal to zero, okay, here you see where the delta tilde is mainly composed of the Bose condensate of molecules and only a small contribution from the original Cooper pairs. So the relative weight of the B molecules and the Cooper pairs in this composite Bose condensate changes as a function, of course, of the detuning. Okay, and this can be calculated. And I say we've calculated this also for the trap gas as well. Okay. Now, here I want to spend a little bit of time on this result here. And this is for Jason. I've actually included a narrow resonance and a broad resonance. So, first of all, and I'm also following the dictum of Eric Cornell, which had a good point, namely that in terms of talking about where we are on the Feshbach resonance, it's nice to talk about 1 over KF A2B, where A2B here I define this way. In other words, A2B is the two-body value of the S-wave scattering length, okay, taking into account for a two-body problem, taking into account the Feshbach resonance. So A2B is defined this way. Yeah? Well, that's this the way, remember, the way I've defined U is, yeah, and that's the way it works out. Yeah. And this formula here, of course, reproduces the usual figure that I showed earlier. Now, and as we've discussed earlier, narrow resonance means a small value G and a broad resonance, a larger value G, and most experiments are in this broad resonance. But this is an example. So specifically in our calculations, a narrow resonance is, you probably can't see this, it turns out in our units, is 0.6 epsilon F, while the broad resonance is, we take G to be 20 epsilon F, which is, I think, type of value Murray often takes. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time about these curves. We just use a simple momentum cutoff, but I mean, this is described in the papers. But I think two epsilon F. Yeah. Now, what I wanted to introduce, this is the concrete example, and again, I think this is for the uniform, I always can remember if our results are for the uniform gas or the non-uniform gas. These results actually are at TC, okay? So here we have no condensate.
Just make a comment. Yep. So yep. That means that any dressing in the open channel, which is at energies higher than that, is already put into your molecules to start with.
Yeah. Okay. And these things are important in the sense that of how you actually define this A to B. But anyway, let's take the narrow resonance to begin with, okay? So here is zero. I don't know how clear this is, but here is zero, okay? That is, A to B is infinite at this point, or right here at zero. Now, the point is, what I've shown here by explicit calculation is the number of B bosons, okay, and I'm going to go through this, and also the number of fermions divided by 2, that's just, so this, remember, this is the BCS region, and this is the BEC region. Now, what happens is we can calculate, of course, obviously, as you go through the Feshbach resonance, the number of free fermions is decreasing, okay? But what happens, roughly, on these units here, minus 1 and 1, you know, sort of viewed as a typical resonance region here. In this region here, you can see molecules, the number of molecules start to appear around this point, okay? This is the narrow resonance. They start to appear. Here, they actually are resonant states. And all in the BCS region, they're always resonant states. They have energy above the two-particle vacuum. But in fact, their lifetime is getting, we've also calculated that the lifetime of these molecules is getting longer and longer, very, very rapidly. So by the time you get into this region here, these molecules are very long-lived, okay? And I'm never quite sure how experimentalists tell how long they're, when they talk about stable molecules. Then at a certain point, what kicks in, for this case, is that this is NB at gamma greater than zero. This notation simply say these are finite lifetime molecules, but as we go lower and lower, the lifetime of these molecules is becoming very, very long, and we can give numbers. Then there's a cataclysmic drop in the number of these decaying molecules, because the blue line describes the number of stable molecules, molecules that have zero, in our approximation, zero imaginary part, okay?
Do you know where this pole is with respect to the atomic continuum?
Now, the first point I want to mention about these guys, you see, is notice that this thing here, to the experimentalist, is very continuous. Here you're dealing with finite lifetime molecules. Here you're dealing with infinitely lifetime molecules. But right in this region, there's no, as far as I can see experimentally, how do you determine between infinite and finite lifetime? But essentially, the number of molecules is described by this curve here, okay? And certainly, if you're studying the number of molecules, okay, in the so-called BCS region, the fact, I mean, for example, I can comment in more detail, but I mean, for instance, the work of Falco and Hank Stuff, who broadly speaking start from the same Hamiltonian, we agree with the same physics, they're really describing the effect, even though this is at TC. These are TC, and we're not dealing with any Bose condensed molecules here. Similar results actually occur, down at T equals zero, which we also have calculated.
This is
at TC. All these results are at TC. But I'm just saying I can show you similar curves where it doesn't really change so much, even at very low temperatures down to T equals zero. So the physics comes out through. In addition, though, So what I'm trying to say is that, forgetting about the details and the subtleties of how you actually precisely define A to B, is that basically in the Feshbach region, on one side in the so-called BCS region, you have very long-lived molecules, and it's a continuous thing. And basically, Falco and Stuff are arguing that, in fact, when people are really studying these molecules, this is what they call Z equals zero. This line here is when the Bose condensate of these B molecules simply disappears. In addition, though, on this curve, and it's unfortunately very bad, I have the number of Cooper pairs, okay? The number of Cooper pairs in the BCS region, which are resonant states, finite lifetime. But again, as we get closer and closer, these Cooper pairs get longer and longer lived. And the red line that occurs here, precisely when these B, remember, these Cooper pairs and the B bosons are very strongly coupled, both of them become stable at exactly the same value. And suddenly the green line here, the number of finite lifetime Cooper pairs disappears, but in fact it's a smooth transition then to the number of stable Cooper pairs. So of course, in the so-called BEC region, you also have, depending on your parameters, a certain number of Cooper pairs existing in the BEC region. Of course, the experimentalists don't really distinguish when they study the so-called molecular Bose condensate. They simply say, well, they've got a Bose condensate of molecules, because while theorists like us can calculate the red curve, the dotted red curve, and the blue curve, in fact, these things come into the theory in terms of this delta tilde, and as a result, this composite order parameter, and I don't see how they can actually distinguish these, at least in terms of these models. Now, the broad resonance is interesting. The broad resonance, taking G to the order of 20 epsilon F, the broad resonance is interesting because here, again, not worrying too much about the details here, here what happens, you could say the Feshbach resonance thing is right here. But anyway, coming back to this, it's very important to note that molecules start when KF A2B is of the order of 1, okay, minus 1, right about here. In any event, for the broad resonance case, you see that in this case, the number of finite lifetime Cooper pairs, is called NC scattering, actually increases as you approach the Feshbach resonance. Their lifetime is getting longer and longer also. And then suddenly, as soon as you go into this, past the Feshbach resonance, the Cooper pairs, so this is in the broad resonance, actually now become stabilized. And at the point when there's very few B molecules arising, they haven't started to build up until well into the BEC region, and you're getting, in fact, in this region, in the Feshbach resonance region, mainly Cooper pairs from the point of view of our calculation. This is only much well into the BEC region that the Cooper pairs finally die out, okay, and the number of B bosons finally build up. And as I say, this is at TC, so we're talking actually about the things not post-condensed, but when we go below TC, the same sort of picture comes out. That is, in the broad resonance case around the Feshbach resonance, actually the way you should think of this composite order parameter is mainly due to Cooper pairs, not B molecules. Now, if you add up all these things, okay, because experimentalists can't really distinguish these things, this is the adding up these various curves. What I have here is the number of fermions, okay, free fermions going like this. This is nu over epsilon F, about 200 in these units, but it sort of corresponds, I guess, well. In any event, that the crossover appears, the number of molecules is building up. So the number of molecules now, I've just added up the number of Cooper pairs, the number of B bosons. But as I say, in this whole region here, the number of molecules is largely Cooper pair in nature. And it's only very up here that the B molecules, remember in this case, this is zero here corresponds to this zero here. It's only in this region that the B molecules play a very important role. In other words, in the broad resonance case, and I think that's other people have come to this conclusion for different reasons, but we agree with it. In the broad resonance case, everything that happens in the resonance region is basically can be thought of as Cooper pairs. And in some sense, therefore, you can go back to a single channel problem, physics. You don't have to worry about the molecule business, because in fact, the molecules don't really arise till when you're well into the BEC region. In other words, this black line here is mainly due to the formation of long-lived Cooper pairs. And the Cooper pairs don't become stabilized at the Feshbach resonance, but get stabilized, this is this red curve here, in fact, I guess they do. Excuse me. Here.
So what about T equals zero for this? What happened to T equals zero for these? So that's a blue line.
Similar things?
So you still have a substantial amount of what in your location?
Here, this one here?
About TC? About resonance?
Well, in the broad resonance, no. In fact, in this language, the role of the B bosons, the molecular Bose condensate. In fact, I would view to the extent that you're dealing with a broad resonance, what Debbie Ginn calls a molecular Bose condensate is actually a Cooper pair condensate.
No, I wasn't referring to that. You have a blue line with stable and unstable pairs.
Yeah.
So
the red thing is the Cooper pairs, and the blue line is the stable bosons.
The faint blue line. So
which one? The faint one here?
Right. So
these are the finite lifetime Cooper pairs.
So
they
the same picture happened at t equals zero?
Yeah. Of course, t equals zero is a funny case because at t equals zero, lifetime effects don't come in. You have to. Right. It's interesting. The difference between t equals zero and even a finite temperature is quite different. But for instance, this is a trapped gas. That's good. This is a trapped gas at t equals zero. Okay, so this is complicated calculation to give here, but here's again in our scale of 2 nu over 2 epsilon f, and here what I mean by the Fermi atoms here, actually, unfortunately, this black line include the Cooper pairs because they're really most associated with that, and the dashed line is the total contribution from the B molecules in the condensate. Okay. So the main thing is this thing here. This is maybe misleading because this includes the number of Cooper pairs in the condensate as well as the Fermi contribution. This is actually, these results are discussed in a recent preprint by Ohashi and myself. And I mean, this is a good example where if you're studying in this region here, okay, if you're studying in this region here, you know, in the so-called BCS region, okay, this is the BCS region here. This, of course, we correspond to A negative. You're basically dealing in a region where you've got a large number of molecules at t equals zero, which are Bose condensed. And the simple fact is, because of this hybridized nature of the problem, on either side of the Feshbach resonance, you have Cooper pairs, a condensate of Cooper pairs and molecules on both sides. And it's sort of a question of how you actually distinguish it experimentally, and I don't really have any ideas how you distinguish it. I might say for the trap gas, this is a point that also comes up. These are results for a trap gas in a paper we published last year, and this is this point I was making earlier, that TC over TF for a trap gas is 0.5, not 0.2, and this is a sort of puzzling.
What's the TF you put in?
TF is for the non-interacting Fermi gas of one of the components.
Yeah, but at which point in the cloud?
Hmm?
At which point in the cloud? Is it the total number divided by the total from the total, the average density?
The TF is like when you're dealing with, say that you didn't have any, you're just dealing with a trapped Fermi gas, right? You have an expression for TF in terms of the trap frequency, h bar omega zero.
Yeah,
six, what is it, 6n cube root and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
What happens, Alan, if I put the TF through the maximum density? Let me assume that I have a very large trap from here to harmonic trap.
Yeah.
Yes. And then what I have in this nice trap is the maximum density.
Yeah.
So if I define the Fermi energy through the maximum density, that's what I can do.
Yeah.
What is then the ratio of TC to TF?
Well, you asked me that actually in last week, I guess, at the conference, and I haven't got around to checking it. All I'm saying is these calculations here are the calculations, okay? The ab initio calculations that come out of our, we don't put this in, we do these calculations. Where the thing comes out to be here, okay, this is the actual calculations, where the thing comes out to be here is TC, you know, normalized to the TF that I described, is this value. Now, you're saying that, I think what you're saying is that what the experimentalists plot when they plot TC over TF, they're plotting a different TF. Is that what you're saying?
Okay.
Because in several people, including our illustrious, one of our chairs here, but also Hank and various other people, have claimed great, beautiful agreement with experimental results of Debbie Ginn and what have you in various connections, which but they make use of the uniform gas results, which is 0.2. You know, and all I'm simply saying, one has to, I think, use the 0.5. You know? And it's a puzzle why the experimentalists disagree with these predictions.
May I comment on Matt, also a question. Is this for the wide or narrow resonance that you have the result you're presenting?
This is for the narrow resonance.
No, yeah. So therefore, now,
but we've done it for the wide, the, yeah, and it also think, occurs, 0.5.
So will you still find an enhancement for the TC? I think Jorah's question is that, I mean, if I have a trapezoid wide, then at the center, then I look more or less like bulk, then how would I get a TC? Higher than the bulk, whereas everywhere I have a lower density and lower TC. So basically, on the average, doesn't seem to be. I wouldn't be able to get the.
Well,
so it must be just that the attractive interaction is. That's with respect to the bare, the non-interacting T family.
Yeah.
I mean, in the discount.
Yeah, well, what we are saying actually is the following.
So when there's attraction, it goes down, the density gets higher,
and
shrinks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The gas shrinks, and therefore the maximum density goes up. And then if I express DC in terms of
this high energy, temperature,
the maximum density will be 8.2, but I have to calculate the density correctly.
Yeah, so how much does the interaction change the density in the center of the track?
Yeah.
I mean, that we can
Let me just quickly just show a plot that might be relevant to that. Is here's a case of broad and narrow resonances, again at TC, where here we've plotted. Remember, sometime earlier I introduced the idea of in this sort of type of theory, it's u plus g squared over 2 nu minus 2 mu, the effective interaction. So one could introduce a many body S wave effective interaction A, okay, this way. So you define A this way. This would be the same as the A to B, except in that case, 2 mu wouldn't be there. Okay? And it's interesting, it was interesting, I've just done this in the last week, where Yoji and I have been discussing it, is trying to replot all our curves in terms of the two-body S-wave scattering length, but it's sort of interesting. One of the things we noted is when you do it in terms of this length, okay, in terms of 1 over A effective instead of 1 over A2B, and you could argue this length is, this effective S-wave scattering length is the important thing in this BCS-BEC crossover. What's interesting, whether or not you're dealing with the narrow resonance, which is the red, or the broad resonance, which is blue. First of all, you notice the two curves almost sit on top of each other, okay, in terms of this variable. And secondly, when we plot the number of free fermions here, I apologize because everything has been switched around, okay. This is BEC and this is BCS and this is BEC and BCS. We sort of keep on inverting this. But it's also interesting how the results of our calculations, which look quite different when we plot them in terms of 1 over A2B, when we plot them as 1 over A effective, the blue curve, which is the broad resonance, and the red curve, which is the narrow resonance, seem to suggest the type of behavior Jason loves only too much, namely a sort of universal behavior, not maybe in the technical sense, but it seems a very interesting sort of observation.
Not too much, but something that everyone should love.
Yeah. And I say, our own view is that this little peak for the broad resonance we understand, and it's basically that in all these mean field theories, and this goes back to Hausmann, one doesn't include the back action of the fact you've got a bunch of decaying bound states which modify the Green's functions of the free fermions, and that when you include that type of effect, you almost always get rid of this little peak here. So, okay, but anyway, let me just backtrack here. Yeah, so we can do these type of curves too, which we're in the process of doing. I mean, this gives, for instance, the composite order parameter as a function of the detuning, essentially, to nu, and the temperature, you know, here's the Feshbach resonance, nu is equal to zero, and this is temperature from zero up to 0.3. This is for a uniform gas, and this is the value of delta tilde, this composite order parameter. And for instance, from these results, one can extract the number of Bose-condensed molecules as a function of these two parameters, both in the BCS region, that's nu positive, and BEC region, nu less than zero. And the thing is, you can see when you look at these curves, there's no big distinction. You know, this is a function of temperature here, and this is for uniform gas. There's no big distinction between when you cross this crossover point here in terms of the Bose condensed region involving, in other words, BEC region involves Cooper pairs and molecules, and the BEC region, in fact, also involves those. Of course, in the two extreme limits, Cooper pairs win out one and boson molecules win out the other. Anyway, I've already made this maybe brief comment about Falcon's too, where I think basically we sort of agree, I think, if Hank was here, and we'll be dame up a couple of days, but we view their work as a simplified version of the model we've worked out. Namely, they have a very clever way of what they call a poor man's calculation, where they can get some basic physics by basically treating the B molecules on the BCS side, which is what I've discussed, but forgetting about the finite lifetime and just working out their properties as stable molecules. And they essentially find out when these molecules in the BCS stage aside sort of finally disappear, what they call Z equals zero. And I say it's a comment, it's not clear to me how experimentalists distinguish between very long-lived molecules and stable molecules. In Hank's calculation, they ignore the finite lifetime effects and mention they should include them. Well, our view is we've done their calculation using what I call a rich man's calculation, namely not a poor man's calculation. We've summed up the Matsubara frequencies and all that other sort of stuff. And that, you know, of course, we get we don't find a sharp transition line such as they do when the BEC of B molecule ceases to exist, what they call Z equals zero. And there's no abrupt change. And to the extent we've had a chance to talk to Hank about this, I mean, sort of broad agreement that our two theories are really the same thing. Let's see here. Here's another example of this many body effects. I've emphasized how this effective interaction, you remember, or this effective A, which I plotted U plus G squared 2 mu minus 2 mu, and of course the tricky thing is to calculate mu self-consistently as a function of this parameter, where this is the BCS side and the BEC side. And this is a good example. Again, this is for a uniform gas, but we have stuff for a trap gas too. The black line, this is for a narrow resonance, for black line gives the results of TC, and the dots give the results of T equals zero. And you can see that this effective interaction simply is very smooth through the transition, which is consistent with the whole picture. But it also says the effective interaction is smooth throughout the crossover, in fact, just as you'd expect from a single channel problem, since originally discussed by Randerian. And in particular, they get a bimodal profile of a thermal gas of, in some sense, Cooper pairs and this sharp peak. In my opinion, as I've loved to bother people like Debbie on, I said that what's really exciting about your work is not your discovery of the BEC of Cooper pairs. We've done that since the cows came home. What's really exciting about your result is you got a thermal cloud of Cooper pairs, unique in this field.
Don't count as a muzzle blocking. Don't count as a muzzle blocking.
Well, do they have a thermal cloud of... Okay. It's nice talking to him. Anyway, this last two slides, I'll just quickly do this. A lot of the stuff I've discussed in connection, just for simplicity, the uniform case, but we've been doing a lot of calculations, and these are very complex calculations, according to Yoji, for the trap gas, and these are just the type of things we get. For instance, we've put some of these results on a con mat just recently, although it was rejected by PRL vehemently by two referees, so we've given up. But in any event, this is part of a long paper that we're in the process of preparing. So these are very complicated calculations, because for the experts, we solved the Degen-Bog-Liebov equations for the trapped Fermi gas. These results are mainly at T equals zero. We haven't done it at finite temperatures yet. And this example is the density states, single particle density states, in terms of the trap frequency. This is for an isotropic trap, when nu over epsilon f is equal to 1. So that's just at the boundary of leaving BCS into BEC, but we have similar curves throughout the crossover. So these sort of results, and from this we can get the energy gap, okay, in units of the isotropic frequency. You notice the energy gap is 0.12. But it's very interesting, we've spent some time on this, just quickly, almost the last slide. And this goes back to my earlier slide, that what we're interested in is working out the theory of the quasi-particles, the remaining fermions, which we feel contain a lot of information. And as I reminded you earlier, E atom, in terms of the energy, is the chemical potential plus the the excitation, the BCS quasi-particle thing. So we've worked out mu, we've worked out delta tilde, we've worked out the, as a function of temperature. And this is an example of the sort of results. So this here is the excitation energy gap, okay? This is the excitation energy gap. That is the excitation energy relative to mu, okay? So it's the excitation gap that comes from this, not for a uniform gas, but these results are for a trapped gas, okay? So we had to sort of work out all the states of the trapped gas and what have you. So the black line here represents the energy gap of atoms, okay? And the dotted line represents the absolute value of the chemical potential. The chemical potential actually is negative in this region here. And you see it's very, very low in the BCS region, but as soon as you go into the BEC region, it starts building up very quickly. Now, it's interesting. This is not what people, this is very important in terms of the theory, but it's not what experimentalists would measure. They would measure the single atom energy gap. They wouldn't measure this gap, but they would measure the energy gap of this guy, including mu. So this, for instance, has, and I say mu, remember, changes sign when you go from the BEC side to the BCS side. So this side here, this plots mu, the dotted line here is mu, and this is the absolute value of mu, because actually mu keeps on going. But this curve here gives the energy gap for atoms, okay? This curve here drops down, and it's very large. This is of the order of EF, of course, the BCS limit. It goes down, and it's sort of small and finite in this region here. But I think measurements that will actually try to measure this energy gap of the actual atoms in the system would be a very direct measure, a probe of the whole theory, but also in particular of delta tilde, which contains the information. This type of, in some sense, experiment can be done by RF spectroscopy that already is done by Debbie Jin and Grimm's group in Innsbruck. And it's really builds on a very nice paper by Torma and Zoller a few years ago in PRL of the information you could obtain about the single particle gap by breaking up Cooper pairs by using RF beams. Let me see. Finally, we've also worked out a whole bunch of stuff on the collective modes of the system. Let me just remind you, the collective modes of the system in a uniform superconductor, of course, you have the collective modes exist below the two-particle continuum at 2 delta. So, and this is the famous Anderson-Bogdanov mode for uniform gas, okay? Soon as, of course, it hits the 2 delta here, which is the energy gap in a simple BCS superconductor, then, of course, the Anderson-Bogdanov modes, these collective modes, disappear. And I think it's this hitting of the two-particle continuum, which is something experimentalists and theorists haven't emphasized enough in recent studies of Grimm and other people on the collective modes, because one of the features they have is that they should have a characteristic strong damping when they get up into the Russ region. So you want to sort of probe that region. That's for the uniform gas. Anyway, we've worked this all out for the BCS-BEC crossover for trapped Fermi gases.
You use that to measure delta?
I think so. Now, for instance, just the last slide here, this is some results that we presented briefly at the Fermi gas conference at Levico and are just in the process of finishing up. So these are the collective modes in the collisionist limit, and I apologize that because we know that, in fact, in some sense, we're probably in a hydrodynamic regime, but what we did was a collisionless thing. These took about 2 years to do these calculations. In a trapped, isotropic trapped Fermi gas, and these are the L equals 2 and L equals 0 collective modes, a monopole and a quadrupole mode. And the only thing I want to mention here, concentrate on this, this is a higher level excited mode, but the essentially energy gap of the excitations comes in here, twice EG. And so this is what our calculations give. And you notice this is a little depression here. And it turns out, particularly for the monopole mode, you see that the collective modes that you might have expected, maybe sort of some simple theory would be just like this, are depressed in the superfluid phase, and we can track this depression down, this suppression, due to this depression in the two-particle continuum, the collective, you know, monopole mode of the condensate, you know, involving this delta tilde, is sort of suppressed because it wants to stay away from being killed by getting up to here. So in some sense, what we're saying is 2 delta now is replaced by 2 EG. It's a very complicated calculation to get EG, and we're the first, I think, to have obtained it for a trapped gas throughout the crossover region. And here are the sort of type of results. So I have a feeling that some of this depression in the frequency of the collective mode might be relevant to some of the recent experiments that we heard a couple of weeks ago or last week or 2 weeks ago at the conference by Grimm and also Thomas. But these are all ongoing calculations. So anyway, there's no qualitative difference, we feel, in this model between the simple mean field approximation extended to finite temperatures of the single channel and two channel models. There's also, experimentally, there doesn't seem to be any difference. There's no fundamental difference, you know, within the context of our calculations of the BEC limit and BCS limit. In particular, we get the usual BCS quasi-particle spectrum valid in the whole region, and the condensate collector modes smoothly changing throughout the crossover region. And in the BEC limit, you have Cooper pairs and molecules, and the BCS limit, you have Cooper pairs and molecules, and it's just a question of the relative components. So at this level, I hesitate to say this here, we have a good understanding of the BCS crossover with the Feshbach resonance, and in some sense, naturally building, in sort of consistent broadly with the original, if you want to call it one-channel ideas of our forefathers, Eagles, Leggett, Nozier, and Randeria. Here is something that just is a private communication from Tony Leggett yesterday. And of course, you'll notice why I put it right at the end, because of course this has been alluded to throughout this talk. Namely, the next step in maybe understanding this two-channel model might be, for instance, to work explicitly with a three-component Fermi gas involving three hyperfine states, A, B, you know, I spin up and spin down, and C. And that, for instance, trying to have a Hamiltonian of that type, and then you could sort of try to keep everything, keep track of everything. In other words, in this language, the open channel would involve bound states between A and B, like the Cooper pairs, and the closed channel then might describe bound states still mainly involving A and B, but might involve B molecules which are some sort of better described in terms of A and C, for example. But this is, I expect to hear about this from Tony maybe 2 days from now in Damov. Thank you. I hope you didn't mind my mentioning this. I think it's a very good idea.
Yep. It looks like your theory predicts a complete transfer between atoms to molecules.
Yeah.
And the experiments, my understanding is the experiments never see that. In fact, Randy Hewlett made a big thing about the 50%.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Is there any explanation to why you don't get a complete transfer?
Well, my understanding is now, like in the extreme BEC limit, well, my understanding now is people do get, approaching 100%. Yeah.
That may not be intrinsic, that is it.
Yeah.
It depends on sleep rate.
Yeah.
Can I go back to your conclusion page?
Yeah.
I do agree with you. Well, I think that the first comment of the first conclusion of there's no qualitative difference, I think that would only be true for the wide resonance. For narrow resonance,
See, the narrow...
That statement is only correct for wide resonance. And
But I can say, remember the results I showed for both, if you think of the single channel, most of our calculations have been done for this statement here is for the narrow resonance. Now, we've done a few calculations for the broad resonance, and we also seem to find this.
Let me
seems to be inverted from what you think.
Suppose now I am at resonance, but I have two types. Suppose one's the wide resonance. Now, the energy density is known to be E to the n to some power.
Yeah.
The narrow resonance, it turns out we're still trying to write. It's n to the 1/4 power, is 1/4 power. Therefore, there is a qualitative difference in the density dependence, the energy density. So, and it would lead to different type of collective modes, etc.
Well, I agree. It's just we haven't examined like all the stuff I was just mentioning at the end there, collective modes and what have you. The detailed calculations we've been doing have been in what we'd call a narrow resonance, and we're pursuing that. It turns out the broad resonance to actually do these numerical calculations is much more machine demanding.
The other comment I would like to have is not comment. Again,
yeah.
The continued discussion is about the TC. I think you make the point that it's important to look at the trap case. I guess I really would like to see for the Y resonance case whether TC also changes so much. Whether because I think the TC for the molecular on the molecular VC is naturally higher just because our molecular content is rich, therefore it's closer to the usual VC result.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's the thing. Let's see. The thing is, there's this one curve where we actually, I think, plot. Where is it here? Yeah, this one here. You see, this is an example of a broad resonance and a narrow resonance, and you know, they both, this for a uniform gas, and here they come out to, you know, 0.2. I mean, there don't seem to be any difference. It's just what those Cooper pairs are. In the broad resonance, the Cooper pairs are mainly, certainly up to this region here. Remember, this is the BEC region now. The Cooper pairs, the BEC region is already achieved just with Cooper pairs. You know, and in contrast to the narrow resonance, the BEC is achieved by having the molecules. But on the other hand, both of them, you know, play this role of part of the composite order parameter. So it's not clear what the distinction is between the two. So I don't know. Yes, a lot of questions, but I think these calculations are useful in the sense they're concrete. I mean, as I say, they're somewhat demanding calculations in terms of machine time, because even in a uniform case, to calculate mu self-consistently according to Ohashi is quite tricky.
Finite temperature.
Yeah. But on the whole, I have to admit, T equals zero is much simpler. And on the whole, we don't seem to get any qualitative differences apart from TCs, you know, the scale of things between finite temperatures and T equals zero. And that's why we're concentrating in T equals zero. And finite temperature, of course, is much more complicated when you're doing the trap and all this sort of stuff. But I think what's interesting in these systems is the fact that the fact that you're talking about these bound states and Bose condensates, but you have to take into account they're often dealing with very long-lived things, and experimentalists don't seem to ever, they seem to always say, well, there's a sharp distinction between a stable molecule and not a stable molecule. What if I give somebody a molecule that's got a lifetime of a minute? You know, I mean, how are they going to distinguish that? And it's probably all related to these ramping times. I'm sure the ramping times is containing information about lifetimes of these various states and all this sort of stuff. But in the Feshbach region, the so-called decaying resonant states are very long-lived. And that's an aspect which is missed in a lot of theoretical calculations, too, because you know, that requires more detailed calculation. That I haven't emphasized here, but we fully include, like the damping of the excitations is fully included, because, for example, when we're talking about our molecule, the molecule can always decay into a particle like this, and that gives rise to a self-energy that gives rise to a shift in the Feshbach resonance from many body effects, but it also gives rise to the damping. And we fully include that in all these calculations. Okay.
Well,
yes. Thank you. Thank you for all the questions.